This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to be talking about a couple of different organizations who are working with cities in their local areas, trying to get them moving forward in the area of renewable energy, energy efficiency. So we're going to start out with Mark Scully and Bernard Pelletier from People's Action for Clean Energy. Why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about what you're doing over there?
Great. Thank you, Sierra, and thank you for this opportunity to share some of what we're doing. So People's Action for Clean Energy, or PACE, has been in operation. It's an all-volunteer nonprofit, started in Connecticut with the purpose of averting the construction of a nuclear power plant in Middletown, Connecticut. But it's morphed over the decades into not just opposing nuclear, but promoting clean energy. And in the last few years, the focus of our work has been moving towns to 100% renewable energy. I don't know if this is true in every state, but in Connecticut, really the building block of getting things done tends to be the town level. You know, the town is where you live. You know people. You know your legislators. And so we've found that working with individual towns, you can see real change. So we typically get engaged with a town or a city through our connections to what we call clean energy task forces. Many towns have these clean energy commissions or task forces. We often work through those people, or somebody raises their hand, gets excited about moving to 100% renewable energy. So they come into us sort of through various means, but really what we do is we take a very pragmatic and hands-on approach. So once a town has sort of said, yes, this is something we'd like to do, we'd like to move towards 100% renewable energy, we'll actually get into the nuts and bolts of what does that mean? What are some reasonable ways of getting there? And we typically start with a town by benchmarking their entire energy usage. So we'll work with them to get data from the utilities, from the electric, from the natural gas utilities, to actually estimate how much energy, how much electricity, how much gas they're using. Residents, businesses, the town itself, we'll go to the grand list and get a list of vehicles and make some assumptions about miles driven and miles per gallon and get the energy usage in transportation. We'll actually go to the grand list and get a list of buildings in town as well and, again, make some assumptions about heating and cooling. So our starting point where the town is really, here's how much energy you're using right now, all in, as I say, residents, businesses, the town, heating, cooling, transportation, electricity. We add it all up, convert it to gigawatt hours, and that's often a very eye-opening exercise in and of itself to see what the mix of transport versus heating and cooling versus versus electricity. So that's really the starting point is, where are we today? And then the next step is if we got serious about energy efficiency and electrifying heating and cooling and electrifying transportation, what would happen to that energy usage, to that energy load? So again, we'll actually do the math. We'll make some assumptions about what it takes to run a heat pump, how many kilowatt hours you need to drive an electric car, and then we'll show. And we typically see through our calculations that a radical reduction in energy usage is possible, somewhere and then between 50 and 65%. Reduction in energy usage, which at first to us seemed very, very aggressive, and we questioned it. But the more we dig, the more research, we find that those numbers are seem, at least we're not the only ones who think that's possible. So the third step is something that is near and dear to from Craig Lewis's heart, and that is a siting survey where we'll actually look in town how much renewable energy could we site in town. We'll go rooftop by rooftop. We'll do some estimates for larger buildings, for larger open spaces. We'll make some assumptions about households and look at really how much energy could we generate in town. Typically, for the population density in the towns we're working, individual towns here are not likely to be able to produce all the energy they need within the town borders, but that's not necessarily the goal anyway. So the rest of that we will seek from regional or sources. And the fourth building block of the work is if you keep adding renewable energy, you keep adding solar and you keep adding wind, the grid as it's currently constituted isn't designed for that. So we really need to rethink the grid. Again, we've worked closely with Clean Coalition and Craig's team to look at things like community microgrids. Where are the places in town where the grid is going to be constrained? Is there hosting capacity? We try to work as collaboratively as we can with the utility to sort of look forward and say we can't just add all these renewable sources. You know, we can't get to 100% with the way that the grid is currently designed. So what are some ways of modernizing that grid, building some community microgrids? And then the last part of the project really is, having done all of that work, how do we get to 100%? So we're gradually building a compendium of best practices, of promoting solar, of promoting energy efficiency, of promoting electric vehicles. And we are currently building a repository of those best practices. So, again, so that's really kind of a high-level flyover of the project, very much in the nuts and bolts, doing the math of what would it take to move a town to 100% renewable energy. Bernie, do you anything to add?
Yeah, I would add two things. First, just the vocabulary. The grand list may or may not be a term that carries across different states, but in Connecticut, we tax our motor vehicles and we have a property tax. And so the good news of all that is we have a listing of every vehicle with a great deal of detail on it, and we have a listing of every residence, every condo, every business, every municipal property on that grand list. So whatever that list is called in your state, that's what we're using. We've built up a relationship, if you want to call it that, with the utilities where they are required to give us the aggregate utility statistics at a residential level and at the business level. So that's another asset that we have and makes this possible. And at the end of our process, I want to mention that Mark mentioned that we team up with the Clean Energy Task Forces. We've been assisted by this organization here called Clean Water Action, which sort of has taken a lot of has been a natural place for us to meet the task forces. And we've also found that it's very good for us to engage with the Sierra Club, no relation to Sierra Dahl, but the Sierra Club that has a Ready for 100 program. We think because we know what 100% is and we have a pathway to get there, we're a natural pairing to work with them as they build up political will in their process. So we've done this in our own right, but we've also found it profitable to engage with other community and nonprofit organizations.
This is Craig Lewis. I'd love to add a couple things into this part of the conversation.
Greg,
is that okay?
Can we let Greg have a chance to talk here, and then we can go ahead and open it up for everybody else to comment. Would that work all right?
It would. I've worked with you know, Mark and Bernie, so my comments are really specific to their efforts. But I can wait if you want.
Okay. No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Mark and Bernie, you guys have such an awesome methodology, and you distill your analysis into really colorful, accessible graphics. I think it would be wonderful if you shared an example of your methodology and kind of the slide decks that you put together for building stakeholder alignment with the group, you know, through Sierra. And I can, you know, I can vouch for the Simsbury, Connecticut example is just awesome, what you guys did. So if, that's one comment. And another is that getting that stakeholder alignment with the municipalities is really critical. Again, you know, going to Simsbury, Connecticut as an example, You know, we all working collectively put together, you know, what I think was a really amazing opportunity for the city of Simsbury and the school district, which is its own municipal district. And we got the city, but we didn't get the school district. And at the end, that really kind of caused a, you know, wonderful community microgrid opportunity to not be able to progress. And so that stakeholder alignment is a super critical element in all of this, and one that you cannot underestimate. You know, when you got to start it right at the beginning and get everybody's buy-in and make sure that you have that before progressing too far, because, you know, each one of those stakeholders can blow this thing up, you know, can blow these types of projects up if they're not on board. So those are my two comments, you know, specific to work that I've worked on in collaboration with Mark and Bernie.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you.
All right, so we'd like to open it up for Greg Peterson from Retant in the Center of Sustainable Community. You want to talk a little bit about what you're doing down there? I'm sorry. Let's try this again. Jeff.
Okay.
I'm all together.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Sierra. Yeah, I'm Jeff Peterson. I'm we did go through a name change, so we're the Center for Community Innovation. And we are kicking off a community effort to community advocacy for renewable energy, conservation, some other environmental-related projects. It's sort of at the center here we have, I don't know, maybe half a dozen initiatives, and this is one small piece of what we do, so it's not 100% of where we focus our time. However, we do have a core group of very motivated individuals who are excited at the prospect. Of course, being in New Mexico, we are in a solar, so a great solar location. The Raton, just a little bit of background. Raton is an interesting situation here. We're a community of about 5,500. We were probably double that, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Have suffered successive collapses of extraction industry, first coal, then natural gas. And we have a community that has somewhat of an infrastructure of water and utilities that's used to a population much larger than what we have now. We're a little bit different in New Mexico in that we are a municipal power company in Raton, as a Raton Public Services, so we're not under the thumb of Public Service Company in New Mexico. Then the second thing is the current power purchase agreement that we have with an outfit called Twin Eagle is expiring in the next 5 or so years. And it's one of these typical contracts where really harsh restrictions on renewable energy, capped at 5%, and we are advocating and pushing that our RPS board does not sign another one of these types of agreements, and that we find a partner for our power purchase agreement that will allow our community over time to expand our own energy generation, our own local jobs, keeping money in our local economy. And so we're all out there learning what we can about community solar, figuring out ways to build this movement and build this advocacy. So very much open ears to learn about the People's Action for Clean Energy and what all you've done.
Okay. So we'll open it up to comments. You guys can talk among yourselves. Karen Eggerman, do you have any comments to make on the call?
I'm sorry, would you repeat that? I was trying to get off mute.
No, I just wondered if you had anything to add to the call here, or anybody, really. I see we have a few other people who are involved.
Well,
let me just do a thing here. You know, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I think the thing that strikes me is partly what Craig was saying about the stakeholder involvement. So in both cases, my first thought is, you know, who benefits from these things and who are those stakeholders, and then what is it that they want or need in order to move to the next step? So that would be the first thing that I would open up. And then also, both probably have cases where they weren't able to bring a stakeholder in to the table. So what did they learn from that, and what was that stakeholder's motivation that they couldn't answer or couldn't satisfy?
Some good thoughts. Any comments on that?
Yeah, Craig, this is Mark Scully. Craig made it, I think, an essential point that we really you do from the beginning of starting one of these projects. You need to get the stakeholder engagement. We were unable to do that in the end for this community microgrid that we were proposing in Simsbury. We kind of knew that going in, that we had a very tentative customer in the Board of Education who had some alternative plans they were working on, a fuel cell instead of a solar and a battery microgrid. So for us, you know, we kind of always knew that was there. So I don't think we ever had the chance to get stakeholder engagement. At least we were not going to get any commitment up front, so we took a shot at it anyway. And in the end, they decided to stay with their plans for a fuel cell. But I think I don't think we would do that again. I think if we see a potential project, I don't think it's worth all the effort. I think for us doing it this time, that one time was a tremendous learning experience, but. I think you've got to have that partner, whether it's the town or whether it's a university or whatever collection you're putting together. That stakeholder engagement is essential. We actually had, as Craig said, we had engagement from pretty much everybody else, including enthusiastic support from the utility. This was the type of a microgrid they liked to support. But the one big partner that we really needed in the end did not come through.
Right. And this is Bernie. I'll just add on to what Mark said. I agree that driving a specific project, in this case a microgrid centered around the Simsbury High School, we would spend a lot more time doing what Craig said, really trying to nail down partners before we spent as much effort as we did. However, going back to Mark's opening comments, where at least the first three steps where you benchmark total community energy use, suggest strategies like strategic electrification, show what they might yield, and do a little bit of solar siting. There's another element of that I think is worth talking about, which is it can be an inspiration to a community. So, for example, there's a community, a very small community of, I think, 2,000 people out in eastern Connecticut. And once we showed them in that instance that they could actually power their whole town relatively easily because they have few people and a lot of land, they said, oh, that's worth engaging on. So their Clean Energy Task Force is adopting a resolution, albeit just an inspirational resolution, that's not a binding resolution, to go do that. So I think there's value. Clearly, if you're going to do something specific, you want to have engaged partners. But this also can be a good seed to get people going. It can be the start of a process.
Rob Hammond has joined us. Rob, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the work you've done with cities, moving them towards the net zero energy?
Sure. The main thing is that I'm sorry I came in late, but we have engaged stakeholders as well in from a number of areas. Local jurisdiction is one of them. But basically, the major and sort of minor business elements that are impacted by this, we've tried to keep them involved in order to avoid things falling apart at the end. But we've been trying to move code toward a zero net energy for some time. It's been part of the strategic plan since 2006. Sorry, lost my train of thought there. And we've been taking steps, including allowing local jurisdictions to go above code if they're moving toward that goal. They're otherwise preempted from exceeding code without proving that their changes are cost effective, and the commission has gone real light on that for jurisdictions that will adopt what would basically be the next version of the code early. We've just had a lot of meetings and focus groups and so forth to just get the ideas out there so that people aren't caught totally unaware. There's still some groups that have been, but for the most part, the building community is ready and somewhat prepared to move to the new code that goes into effect in January.
Okay. All right. Rob is out in California. He's with Bureau of Energy, and Craig Lewis also out in California, Clean Coalition. So, Rick Fripstein, any thoughts about this in Massachusetts?
Can you ask me more specifically when you say about this?
What experiences have you had, if any, with your students or with you working with cities and moving them forward into net zero energy type scenarios, renewable energy?
Well, I guess I can talk a little bit about the fact that BU students are participating in some of the discussions around the Boston decarbonization effort. So we have a particular Professor Cutler Cleveland, who is really the leader of that technical analysis for the city. And then we're supplementing that with a number of projects. So the students have been looking at greening, urban greening, tree retention, forest conservation, as well as placement of solar on contaminated sites, and community solar and community aggregate purchasing of cleaner energy. So they've been looking at a number of different options that cities have. Recently, this has taken the turn of looking at eco-gentrification, and they've actually put together a vision which is, I want to just mention its name, it's transitioning environmental justice neighborhoods into green communities, transforming. So it's kind of a vision, and it includes the discussion of workforce development and local economic development as a way to accomplish all of these things, and having policies that don't just keep dirty industries out of impacted areas, but bring in and develop a cleaner economy. So it's if you improve the neighborhood, you're going to have gentrification. So you need to couple that with affordable housing, that local economic development, and better policing of and better management of landlord-tenant relationships. So a lot of things are necessary, but the investments in the communities are worthwhile. And right now the administration is promoting opportunity zones, and if those lead to a lot of privatization investment that looks at poor areas as an opportunity and you know, vulnerability and rebuilding of urban areas as an opportunity for just making money, that's a very different approach than designing something from the start for the benefit of the local community. So we're trying to get our arms around that big picture now.
All right. Chris Carrick, do you have anything to add to this conversation? Chris is from New York.
Thanks, Sierra. So I'm based in Syracuse, New York. I manage the energy program for a regional planning agency, and we've done quite a lot of work with municipalities doing climate action plans, greenhouse gas inventories, working on a microgrid project through the New York Prize program, working on a portfolio of community solar projects with 20 municipalities in the region. So a lot of this certainly resonates with my work. I guess I have a somewhat technical question around the issue of beneficial electrification and what kind of analysis was done in terms of looking at within a community if 100% or 50%, whatever number, of residents switch to electric vehicles and heat pumps, what impact that would have on the grid, because that's certainly an issue that is forefront here in upstate New York. I know that you mentioned partnerships with utilities and certain access to aggregated utility data, which would be helpful. You also mentioned capacity hosting maps. I'm not sure what's available in Connecticut, but we do have those in New York. The utilities are required to publish hosting capacity maps. But that just seems like the tip of the iceberg in terms of the information that would be needed to do the analysis. So if you could say a little bit more about, you know, how do you actually do the math, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, so this is Bernie, and with the strategic electrification or beneficial electrification, we have it's a simplistic analysis. Basically, when it comes to vehicles, we make an assumption about the current vehicle fleet. Mark alluded to it. I think we're assuming that current vehicle fleet in aggregate is about 23 miles to the gallon. We turn that into an amount of currently consumed energy at the point of, in other words, we take that fuel and we turn it into gigawatt hours. And that's sort of our representation of where we are today. And then we use what I would call the Chevrolet. You can use the Prius hybrid test. What you do is you take a plug-in hybrid where you can see their numbers in gas mode and their numbers in electric mode, and you look at the ratio of miles per gallon electric versus miles per gallon gas, and that gives you the sort of the beneficial or the energy reduction component. So you take today's, if you're using 100, our basic math says you come down to 40. If you're using 100 gigawatt hours of power now from gas and diesel, by electrification, by virtue of all its benefits, you'll knock it down about 60%. So that's, and at the end of the day, our view is that if you look at electricity as an energy source now, if it's call it 10 now, it'll be 20 at the end of this process. But everything, in other words, we think will double the consumption of electricity, but that'll be the only energy source that we're using, and it'll be powered locally.
And I think it's safe to say we've just scratched the surface in terms of what impact will this have on the grid as the numbers increase, as the numbers of heat pumps and electric vehicles and the potential for the battery, timing of charging, and potentially even down the road the use of batteries to support the grid. We really haven't gotten into that in any meaningful way yet. The numbers are still so small, but we have started to have some conversations about that kind of stuff. I think that's something we're all going to probably be paying a lot more attention to.
Yeah, and if I can just comment further, like being from Syracuse, and we know upstate New York, it's sort of the boogeyman that various people pull out will be excess demand in a very cold situation for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. And we haven't solved that problem, but we're 100% sure that it is solvable. So we have not, as Mark was saying, we haven't gone into that level of analysis yet, looking at peak demand. But I think there are solutions.
This is Greg Lewis.
I just want to follow up very quickly. I agree that, you know, even the utilities and certainly NYSERDA has just barely scratched the surface themselves on this issue. But when I talk to the folks at National Grid, you know, they are concerned that, you know, if everyone were to come home and plug in their cars at the same time on a particular distribution circuit, that, you know, that could have some pretty negative impacts. So I think collectively, you know, all of us energy planners out here in the field trying to push the envelope need to start thinking about this in more detail.
Absolutely. I just jump in ahead of Craig for 1 second. One of the things that comes off our grand list analysis as a mitigating factor is the percent of homes that heat with resistance heating. And so clearly there's going to be more electrical demand. It's going to be a bigger thing to worry about. But if we were to take all existing electrically heated businesses and homes, and we find a lot of condo complexes built in the 50s and 60s, it's typically about 7% of a building inventory. If we're able to, one, improve their building shell, and two, move them from resistance heating to heat pump with maybe backup propane or something like that, it would free up a lot of demand and a lot of electrical capacity. You know, I'm going to say for 5 years, if we're able to focus on that. So there are mitigations that are within our power to grasp. Just a quick comment.
Yeah, and this is Craig, and I'm glad Bernie jumped ahead of me there because, you know, he's getting at the energy efficiency play where we can shrink electricity usage, which is important. Hopefully, as we, you know, really transition to beneficial electrification or whatever term you want to use, fuel switching to electricity away from natural gas, et cetera, the other big solution is demand response. And that means to use the ability to load shift and the ability to turn down, you know, electrical usage for non-critical loads or flexible loads such that you can smooth out the load curve. So demand response is a huge play, and the Clean Coalition is very involved in power flow analysis. We basically in California are the reason that the what are called the interconnection capacity analysis maps were forced, the utilities in California were forced to produce those. We got that done about 7 years ago, and thankfully other states like New York have followed suit. Those maps are critically important, and for those of you that don't follow the California ICE, you know, interconnection capacity analysis proceeding, the utilities were required to produce much more detailed maps, and those recently came online. They're called the ICA Interconnection Capacity Analysis 2.0 maps, and those are now available and have a lot more detail and information, and hopefully other states will follow suit because those are exactly what you need in order to know how much of an issue you're going to have on a particular feeder circuit. And even more specifically down to the node level on a feeder. So, you know, a sub piece of a feeder. And that's the kind of resolution we now have in the California ICA 2.0 maps. But back to the demand response as being a really important part of the solution set. The person who's joining me on the call today, Henry Meyer, is the CEO of a company called Lilypad, which is a demand response company. And they're bringing the reason that he and I are spending most of the day together today is that he's working on solutions to bring solar and storage and demand response combined into markets here in California and to tie those to tie demand response into electric appliances like water heaters, heat pumps, you know, electric dryers, washers, electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Anything that is an electrified appliance is a potential play for demand response. And I asked Henry earlier in this call privately if he would be willing to give a webinar to provide an educational background on demand response to this group, and he, you know, eagerly agreed to do that. So, Sierra, that's an offer for you. If you think demand response is something that warrants a webinar on your upcoming calendar, then I can put you in touch with Henry.
That sounds great. I'd love to do that.
Quick question. The gentleman from Syracuse, is that Chris Carrick?
Yes, it is.
Great, thanks.
This is Rob. I'd love to hear more about the work that Henry's doing. We've done some work out here in California, building homes and measuring the impact on the grid and such things. And one of the problems that I think is a looming problem for California when the new standards go into effect. And by the way, they allow a trade-off between batteries and energy efficiency, and I think that's absurd. But anyway, that's what's going to happen. And the building industry seems more inclined to spend more money on batteries than they're going to spend on upgrading efficiency levels. Anyway, one of the problems with that is that I don't see that there are control mechanisms available for managing the impact of a massive battery market uptake, assuming it happens. I don't think the control systems are there to mitigate the possibility of things, of the batteries either dumping to the grid or they're not supposed to draw from the grid, but they need to be controlled. And if they're on the customer side of the meter, that makes it difficult for the utility to manage those batteries, especially unless you totally ignore privacy impacts. So that's a point that I'd be interested in hearing more about from Henry. Regarding low-income multifamily, we've done a fair amount of work in that area as well, and there are some mitigating factors that we can get energy efficiency cost-effectively into those dwellings, and it could be simply a good marketing and utility incentive program possibilities, except that we run into two major things that are outside that are side effects, one being that we have to upgrade the electrical supply system in some circumstances, and that can double the cost of the efficiency upgrade. And the other is that we run into asbestos and the removal and disposal of the asbestos also doubles the cost. And I think there's a real need for some social changes that recognize the massive number of such complexes that need to be upgraded, and there are barriers that are just too large for some of the simpler programs to get over. The last thing I want to mention is in terms of excess demand from heat pumps in particular during the winter, we need to convince the heat pump manufacturers that they really don't need strip heat anymore. Cold weather heat pumps, at least in California, are quite capable of meeting the load without the use of heat strips. But the industry relies on them to make simple changes in the operation rather than training the consumers how to use them. In other words, they get fast response out of the heat strips, and people tend to live with higher bills and, of course, much higher demand on the grid during cold spells instead of properly managing the temperature given that it's a heat pump.
Was that Ron?
Rob.
Sure. Rob.
Rob Hammond, yeah.
Rob, one point that you mentioned I want to throw out to the group because it triggered a response. So I guess this is a demand response, actually, is that our utility here in Connecticut, and I don't know if it's universal across the country, has an enormously difficult problem with low-income people. A lot of people just don't pay their bills, and here you cannot cut off electric power in the wintertime, at least in a lot of situations. And the reason I bring that up as a good thing is that in that regard, I think the utility would be incented to work with us on things like efficiency because they have an enormous amount of unpaid and difficult to collect bills from low-income people. So that might actually be a self-funding form of efficiency program that would make sense. And it might be different in California because your weather is so different, but it's a real phenomenon here in Connecticut that I only recently became aware of.
Good question.
And Rob, I'll add a little bit more to in response to some of what you said. I agree that the energy efficiency is critical, and we need to really focus on getting on megawatts, right? Getting energy usage, including electricity usage, minimized. On the batteries points that you made. The big play for batteries, the Clean Coalition does a lot of work on microgrids and community microgrids, and the big play for batteries is resilience and making sure that people can keep critical loads on when the grid goes down. With respect to the utilities having a need to know what's going on with batteries behind the meter, they don't actually need that because the way that the rules are structured, and these rules are structured both in the rate tariffs like net metering tariffs, and they're also structured into the interconnection tariffs like Rule 21 in California, you cannot export any energy out of a battery, period. So there is no need. Batteries are only delivering energy that is used for on-site load. So the utilities have actually constrained the use of batteries so much that it's very hard to make the economics work because of how constrained they are. And we need to change that. But as of the way the policies and market mechanisms are structured today, you don't actually have to worry about those concerns that you mentioned.
Okay. I'm curious, though. I understand and agree with the need for resilience, but a 500 kWh battery, for instance, isn't going to do much. Well, the average outage time in California for a IOU consumer is 1 hour. So that could never justify putting in a battery for that purpose. So we would really be looking at much bigger problems due to climate change and disasters that are occurring here. I understand how batteries in general could help with long-term resilience, but I think the way we're going at it, it'll have a very small impact on that in any major disaster.
Yeah, I think having the trade-off between energy efficiency and a battery is a false, right? That shouldn't be coming into play. So I agree with you on that. In terms of resilience, Clean Coalition works with lots of municipalities, fire districts, school districts, water districts. All of those folks have critical loads, and they all need resilience. They're either going to have a diesel generator or they're going to have solar plus storage. Yeah, so there's lots of opportunities for resilience, renewables-driven resilience out there, and we need to make sure that they are renewables-driven instead of diesel-driven or natural gas-driven. So I think we need these things to play together. Energy efficiency is key. I don't want anything to get in the way of energy efficiency, but I am also a believer that we need to have renewables-driven resilience, which means you need to have the batteries into the mix.
I agree. The part I'm talking about is residential new construction, which is, in my view, the wrong place, the wrong market, the only benefit of doing that is it may drive down the cost of batteries.
We're kind of drifting off a little bit. Guys, we're kind of drifting a little bit on the topic here, and I'd like to see if Kalina, Rob has anything to comment on in the areas of working with cities and renewables, and also Okshun, do you have, you're online here too, so Kalina, do you have any comments to make?
Not at this moment, I'm just listening intently.
Okay, Okshun, do you have anything to comment on?
I do have a question real quick. This is mostly for Mark and Bernie. Hi guys. I was wondering about the sort of benchmarking activity that towns are that you're encouraging towns to do. And to me, I mean, having worked a little bit in the Connecticut towns, it's sort of very surprising that these sort of basic information data collection is not happening sort of more naturally, and that it's really certain towns are leading the effort, but there's no sort of concerted, broad effort to benchmark. I mean, to me, it really starts with this basic information, and you are with PACE, of course, you're doing a great job of showing the way of how to do the math, essentially. So along those lines, I'm wondering if you are also working with the state, with the DEEP especially, in terms of collecting the data as opposed to sort of voluntarily, asking sort of for this information voluntarily. And I wonder if there's a more sort of state-level data collection that can be done. It's really mind-boggling to me that that we don't already have this information, or the DEEP is not providing the Department of Energy and Environment is not providing this information for towns, and it's sort of on a voluntary basis. So if they could comment on that, that'd be great.
Yes. So this is Bernie. This DEEP has been helpful to us because without going into Connecticut politics, a couple of years ago, the aggregate numbers almost sort of went away, but the aggregate numbers for natural gas and for electricity are available on a website that anybody can access. But Mark and I have gone into over 15 towns now, and nobody has ever looked at them. So there's not a lot of demand for them except for us. But DEEP was instrumental in making sure that the utilities continue to publish those numbers, and they've sort of helped on them foot dragging. The other piece, though, of monitoring the motor vehicle consumption and the heating fuel and the propane and the kerosene heat, i.e. the stuff that does not come through utilities, I agree with you that it would be helpful if the state were to become – I think everybody should know these numbers, and the state could play a valuable role there. Because, honestly, I think Mark and I are getting tired of doing Excel spreadsheets to calculate all this.
Right.
And I think there is, like I said, we've gone into some pretty smart towns, and I won't name them, but nobody has ever known at the community level how much energy they use. Nobody. So it's always a revelation, which is kind of sad these days. And let me add one other thing, and I should have mentioned this earlier on. As Mark said, we calculate the sort of the natural gas, kilowatt hours, gallons of fuel, that sort of level. We convert it to kilowatt hours. One thing that falls out almost automatically from our spreadsheet is, I call it a local greenhouse gas inventory. So it doesn't have embedded energy from manufactured goods, but any metered energy in your community and any burned energy in your community, we can calculate the greenhouse gas ramifications of that. And that has been an attractive feature to our capital city, Hartford, is using our approach to work on a greenhouse gas inventory.
And you can also look at the same data through an economic lens, and Bernie has done this analysis where you can look at, if we actually did this, how much more money would stay in the pockets of our town citizens.
Right.
Business.
But I would welcome help from the state.
I also wonder if some of this benchmarking could be done at the household level. I mean, how cool would it be for individuals to sort of, I mean, I know there's certain apps, for instance, that sort of calculate one's carbon footprint, and, you know, there's sort of, I guess, interesting mechanisms out there for sort of a personal or household, at the household level. But I wonder if something like the way that you did it, maybe if whether or not that could be also brought down to the household level, I wonder.
Absolutely. I mean, that what we've done, nothing of it is advanced science. This is not NREL material. This is basic Excel spreadsheet stuff. And I think there would be a benefit of doing it at the household level, because one of the things that I think we all, I'm going to bet all of us on the call have encountered, is that people are basically unconscious of the amount of energy that they consume. And so
absolutely,
our calculations have shown that the per capita, and that's every man, woman, baby in our state, uses between 35,000 and 45,000 kilowatt hours per year. And that just floors people when you tell them that, because, and so it would be an easy thing if we knew how many cars, we knew how big your house was, we knew what your utility bills was. It would be easy. We could put it into an app. We could become rich.
Okay. This is Queen Rob. Can I ask, I know at Virginia we've tried to, there's been some effort at the state General Assembly to legislate benchmarking or reporting, and there's been resistance to that. Have y'all run into that in other states? Meaning that the problem is getting the data from the local businesses.
Oh, see, we just, so the utilities have basically said they worry, quote, about privacy. That's mm-hmm. Somebody else mentioned that earlier in this call. And I think that's a legitimate concern, sort of. So we do it at an aggregate level. And at the aggregate level, I don't think there is any privacy issues. So that would be my response to anybody who tried to invoke a privacy concern.
So the utilities, yeah, you can just get all the data you need directly from the utilities.
You can. They'll never give you Bernie Pelletier or Mark Scully's numbers, or they shouldn't give you that. But if you said, what's the consumption in the town of Simsbury or the town of West Hartford, they should be able to give you that. So there's okay. No privacy issue there with the town.
We have had issues where we then go into the town hall and say, can we see the property tax record so we know, can you give us a list of vehicles and a list of buildings in town? Generally, we've been successful at that, but I think, Bernie, you've run into at least one town where they blocked that data.
Yeah. I think for some people read the statutes very strictly, overly strictly, and some people, I think, are just not willing to do anything that's not in their exact job description. So laziness and over-scrupulousness have been two things that we've encountered.
Jeff Peterson, do you have any thoughts or comments about this?
We actually have pretty good luck getting the data about at least our electrical usage and the high users, and data from the city about which buildings are high users. We haven't looked at the gas usage and trying to calculate like this overall energy picture, which is interesting. We do have some good conservation folks in town that know a bit or two about especially residential improvements. So we've been talking about conservation in a little bit, but the numbers you're talking about the impact on power usage by going through a few key exercises on conservation have kind of piqued my interest, and maybe that's a direction we need to spend a little more time and a little more building of ideas or programs on the conservation side.
Jeff, this is Bernie. I've been unsuccessful, and I would dearly love to get what I would call the energy nightmares, i.e., whether they be residential or businesses. That you could set some metric that kilowatt hours consumed or 100 cubic feet of natural gas consumed per square foot is so far out of pattern, because going back to what Craig Lewis was talking about, the potential for energy savings, I think there's that Pareto rule. I'm going to guess that if we were able to deal with the bottom 20 or the worst 20 energy consumers, we would make enormous headway in terms of energy conservation. So you're not going to get much left out of my house anymore. I'm not worth subsidizing. I've done pretty well for myself. But I go around here in West Hartford, my town, and I look at buildings where people have the heat on and the window open, or I can see that they haven't changed their lights. I can see, you know, I think that would be very – have you actually got that where you get the worst offenders? Or however you name it?
You know, a little bit. I think that would be really cool. Like you said, the Pareto rule, and there haven't been really organized efforts on the conservation side, so there must be some really low-hanging fruit. And luckily, you know, we have some, like the city and the school system have been talking about solar for the schools, and so there's an openness. I don't think there's like an antagonistic relationship to all of this from the municipal power authority. So they're open to these conversations, open to learn. So we're kind of positive on our ability to guide this a little bit towards renewables. But we certainly need to be sharper and more knowledgeable in our approach, because the board that operates the municipal power authority is basically a group of retired folks, and several of which worked in the coal industry and so forth. So they're not industry experts by any means. They're, you know, they rely a lot on the consultant to say what's the way to go. We have an opening, and we kind of need to take advantage of it pretty quickly here.
Yeah, it might be interesting for somebody like Craig Lewis, who works with for-profit utilities, to see if there wasn't a way to, maybe even a limited frame, to take the bottom 20 or the bottom 10, and maybe by quantifying the potential megawatts and actually paying the utility to make it worth their while, I think we could move the ball forward quite a bit. If we could get, I understand you have some control over your municipal power utility, but for us that are dealing with like our Eversources and our Connecticut Natural Gas and Avangard and so forth, they're going to want to be paid.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just jump in real quick and make a comment, which is that Tompkins County did an analysis that really their utility, NYSEG, should have done, but there was concerns around natural gas capacity constraints and electrical grid constraints and how that might limit economic development. And so the county, working with their Cornell Cooperative Extension Office, did sort of a bottom-up analysis to look at what load constraints might be in the future, and they found none. Again, I think utilities should be doing this kind of work, but this might be, you know, a way to pitch municipalities on participating in this kind of exercise. They're all concerned about economic development. And then the other comment I would make is really a question. I don't mean to be provocative, but why are we concerned with 100% renewable planning at this point, given all of the lack of data that we have about particular feeder capacities that I was talking about earlier? Is the point of this kind of exercise really just to kind of put a vision out there and to rally stakeholders and gain some traction around specific projects like microgrids? What is the benefit of doing this?
This is Craig Lewis. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, Craig.
Okay, I'll go first. I think the comments are, you know, I think that's right, and we're so far away from 100% in just about every place, right? Even in California, that this is like a decade long plan. But I think it is that vision and setting that beacon out there and then taking inventory. And I think what Mark and Bernie have done in Simsbury and other places where they've taken inventory of how much energy usage there is. You have to start. I mean, if you're going to get to 100%, you gotta have some details, right, in order to make a plan to even begin to get to 100%. And then you need to start doing projects, you know, here and there, and where the locations where it makes the most sense to put solar and storage, for example. I mean, you can start packing up renewables as much as you can. You're still a long ways away from 100%, no matter where you're talking in the country. And then solar and storage makes and microgrids make sense at the places where you have resilience requirements. So I think that your question was kind of a statement, and I think it was correct. You need the beacon out there to create the vision and get alignment, and then you need to make a plan that kind of gets you, you know, to take steps that will eventually achieve the vision, but it's going to be a long process.
Yep. We're just about out of time. We are out of time, actually, so go ahead, one more comment, and then we'll end the call. Go ahead.
Just to follow on Craig's answer, I think that really says it all. I mean, the 100%, it is a vision. It was a sense of curiosity. Could we do it? I think in reality, when we get to 90 or 95%, we're probably going to start to ask, gee, for the investment required for that last 5 or 10%, is there a better way of using that? So I think, but we'll have that, you know, I'm happy to have that discussion when we get to 90%.
All right. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and end the call now. I sure appreciate everybody for attending, and thanks for Jeff Peterson and Mark Scully and Bernie Pelletier and all the rest of you for joining the call. And we're going to have another call coming up here in the end of March, and it'll be a microgrid on March 26th. Oakshawn has done some very interesting research on why cities and towns are either interested or not interested in moving forward in the area of renewable energy. So, and I'm not quite sure what the other call is going to be yet. Well, I guess I am. It's going to be on microgrid updates and looking at community microgrids, and Craig Lewis will be on that call. I assume, Craig, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So we have a few other folks who will be on the call as well. So we're looking at a microgrid call on the 21st, and then on the 26th of March, we're looking at the research that Oakshawn has done. So I hope to see all of you there, and look for the invitations. I'll be sending them out on Monday. And thanks again for everybody for attending.
Thanks, Sierra.
Thank you, Sierra. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.